tonight on Arena. Origin and Copa 71 are among the movies up for review, and opera superstar Elena Garancia on her performance tomorrow night at the National Concert Hall. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena if you want to have access to the live screen rather than scream. Although there might be some screaming in the next item between these two reviewers. Our reviewers this evening: Origin is a film by Ava DuVernay, who spoke to us yesterday on the show. This is based on Isabel Wilkerson's book Caste: The Origin of Our Discontents, and explores how race has been manipulated to create social hierarchies all over the world. High and Low is a documentary by award-winning director Kevin McDonald. This explores the rise and fall of controversial fashion guru John Galliano. Next, the Romanian film Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. It's about an overlooked production assistant called Angela, who drives, hustles and shouts her way around Bucharest, desperately looking for actors to cast in a workplace safety video commissioned by an Austrian multinational. And finally, Copa 71, a sports documentary directed by Rachel Ramsey and James Erskine. This tells the extraordinary story of the 1971 Women's Soccer World Cup in Mexico, a tournament that was witnessed by record crowds but was then written out of sporting history. It's with me in studio this evening, Tara Brady and Chris Wasser. And we'll start with Origin. You've seen this, Tara. I spoke with Ava DuVernay on the show last night, and it's based on Isabel Wilkerson's book Caste: The Origin of Our Discontents, which is a book of social theory, sociological theory, philosophy, history, all sorts of ologies and isms in the midst of it. And I said to Ava DuVernay, how on earth did you think that you could take such a theoretical book and turn it into a feature film? Because that's what she did.
Yeah, I mean, there's a history of an interesting subgenre there. For example, Woody Allen's Everything You Want to Know About Sex. There was also a comedy based on Mean Girls, of course, which was also a sociological book. So there is something there. But generally speaking, when people try to dramatize books, it ends up with something like Richard Linklater's Fast Food Nation, if you remember it from just over 10 years ago, he's a very good director. It's a really interesting book, big bestseller. He got together this amazing cast, and it just didn't work at all, because he's trying to dramatize all these different strands. So what Ava DuVernay has done here is really remarkable, because there's so much to unpack here. And what she's done is like found little stories and little things to hang it on. I suppose the big organising principle is that she's actually brought the author into the story.
And the author's life at the time while she was writing this book, again, if you saw it in a fiction, you would say, none of that. That all couldn't have happened to her. Yeah. She had a horrific time.
Yeah, no, so she
in terms
loses
of personal
she,
loss.
She loses her husband, and she loses her mother, and then there's the business that which we were talking about not that many weeks ago, but of going back to your house. When we were talking about it in relation to all of us strangers, and that flavour of going back to your house and unpacking things that belong to people, and then as an analogy to that, unpacking all this history that takes us to Nazi Germany, that takes us to the history of the Dalit or untouchable class in India, and then that takes us to the death of Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, and she starts with the death of Trayvon Martin, and we hear incredible real footage, telephone audio recordings of the 911 call that was made the night that Trayvon Martin was killed. It's spine-tinglingly chilling. I wasn't surprised by the amount of African American material that was there, but the bit that stopped me in my tracks, I have to say, was the moment when the Isabel Wilkerson character, who's played by Ellis Taylor in the film, when she discovers just by a little finicky bit of research that the Jim Crow laws were being discussed in Nazi Germany at the time when the final solution, to use that awful phrase, was being devised.
There's lots of little discoveries like that. Like, I love the scene where she goes to India as well and she's talking to someone and then suddenly realises, oh, wait, Martin Luther King was here.
Yeah.
And he actually spoke on this
this
very topic. And it's just that I suppose one of the lovely things about the film, and it's a very moving film, and it brings to like a real sort of humanity to like very big subjects. But there's also alongside that this lovely the voyage of discovery and the joy of research and of finding little nuggets and going, oh, that's a whole other thing that I hadn't considered. This is my way in. And because it's a book that sort of brings all these kind of disparate strands together, those nuggets are really important, and they are really joyful moments.
Yeah,
as well.
there's a wonderful moment with her husband where they've had a row and they come home and just disagreement really is all they've had on the way home in the car, and they're not speaking to each other, and he simply says, "Will I make you some pasta?" And you know, that's the apology.
Yeah.
And it's so understated and so beautifully done.
And I really like as well that the like favourite scenes out of this movie for the entire thing. But the bit where Nick Offerman is playing, he's playing a Trump supporter and he's got the MAGA hat and he's in the debate, and suddenly they start discussing the fact that their parents have died, and they have that conversation. It's just a lovely, beautifully constructed scene.
However, it did strike me that the parallels between slavery in Nazi Germany and the idea that the Jim Crow laws were there, that was a huge moment in the film. And not everybody agrees with that thesis within the book. And I'll play a scene where we get a sense of that. This is Wilkerson, the author, played by ingenue Ellis Taylor here. They're at a dinner party, other guests, including Connie Nelson, and they're talking about whether this idea of the Holocaust and slavery, whether they can sit side by side.
Well, there are so many differences between here and there. We're talking about the systematic murder of 6 million Jews. That's the official number. So it's just very different than monuments to soldiers and whatnot.
What are you saying is different?
All of it. We're talking about deliberate extermination over many years.
Yeah, but wasn't slavery for like hundreds of years, right, Isabel?
Slavery lasted 246 years. That's 13 generations of people, plus another 100 years of Jim Crow segregation, violence, and murder.
It is, of course, horrific. I am not downplaying any of it.
There were so many millions of African Americans who were murdered from the Middle Passage until the end of legal segregation, that it goes beyond the realm of an official number. There is no number.
I didn't know that.
Oh, stunning.
It is, and I understand you're trying to make sense of American racism. It is noble. But your thesis linking caste in Germany with the United States is flawed.
And that's Connie Nielsen there as the dinner guest of Wilkerson, the author, played by ingenue Ellis Taylor in that scene from Origin. And I was saying to her as we were listening to that, that's the clip that the official clip that they have out there. And it makes it sound like a boring theoretical film, but that's very misleading. It's a much more human exploration than that.
How it's such a masterful piece of storytelling, and the way it does that is that it zeroes in on very, very small human stories. It's like these little vignettes. So you get everything about Nazi Germany through the person of August Landmesser, who was photographed in a very famous photograph in 1934, and he's the only person in a crowd of workers not giving the right hand salute, because he's become disillusioned with the Nazi Party because he's fallen in love with a Jewish woman, and they take that and she dramatizes that story, and that's your way in, and I think it's just brilliant. And also the way that she crafts in real things, like she crafts in a real interview, she crafts in Martin Luther King's actual speech,
and the people that the Dalits who are scooping up excrement are actual men who do that work on a daily basis. It is an extraordinary film. It is a bit long, however. What are you saying overall?
I'd give it a high four. It's definitely a bit long, but it has a lot of strands going on, so there's a lot going on. But you know, it's a film that I think will stay a long time in your mind afterwards.
Yeah, still with me, and I'd like to go back and watch it a second time just to get a little bit more. All right, let's move on then to High and Low, John Galliano documentary by the Academy Award winning director Kevin MacDonald, exploring the rise and fall of the controversial fashion guru that is John Galliano. How did it all go wrong? What was going so right, Chris, and how did it all go wrong?
Up until around 2010, I'd say actually even up until around 2007, John Galliano was among the most famous fashion designers in the world. He was the head of his own fashion house. He was the head of high fashion at Dior. He designed and worked with everyone from, you know, Kate Moss to Naomi Campbell, Charlize Theron, Penelope Cruz. He would dress these extraordinarily famous and wealthy people for, you know, runways, for their weddings. He had friends in very high places, so wealthy. It was all going very right for him, but he was also overworked and thinly stretched, and he was expected to, you know, have 32 lines for Dior and then various other lines for his own brand. He was drinking too much. He was actually obsessed and addicted to a very unhealthy exercise regime. And in 2007, it all came to a head when his best friend and his assistant, Stephen Robinson, died. He was only in his late 30s, and that hit him hard. And over the next couple of years, he just started to do an awful lot more of the things I just said there. You know, he wasn't eating right. He was drinking. His drinking habits were quite unhealthy. And then in 2010, he was videoed at a Parisian cafe. Footage emerged of him lashing out at strangers and just saying the most despicable anti-Semitic comments to complete strangers, seemingly unprompted. Not that makes a difference at all, but just insulting all of these people. Yeah. And the video came out, and it wasn't even an isolated incident. He hadn't even done it twice. He'd done it three times. Yeah. And as a result, he was criminally fined, convicted, and dropped from Dior. So he was right at the top, Sean, and then all of a sudden found himself out of work.
At the very bottom. And Kevin MacDonald does ask him a question quite earlier on, you know, will you tell me how all of this happened? And Galliano says, I'm going to tell you everything. And when I heard that in the opening sequence of the film, why do I think he's not going to tell us everything?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really entertaining film, and I think it's certainly not a puff piece. It's certainly not a big MacDonald does ask really interesting questions. There's certainly questions to be asked about the fashion industry in general, the way they rallied around him, the way they uncancelled him almost as quickly as he was cancelled. There's also questions about the way the fashion industry just latches onto these people. Yeah. I mean, at one point he's designing 32 collections in a year. Like, that's not humanly possible to do. And it's the same kind of pressure, of course, that led to Alexander McQueen's suicide. So, like, why not let these kind of bright lights shine in their own? Why keep sort of sucking them in and piling more kind of pressure on them? Because in order to sort of associate your brand with this person who's a kind of leading light. There are so many smoking guns here as well. Like, MacDonald leaves around the idea that, oh, well, it's his Catholic Gibraltar upbringing and it's all these kind of pressure and all this, but none of that really does account for what he does.
And do we get Chris any kind of reasoning, that any kind of account for
not
why he did what he did?
No, it's very strange. It seems to be for the first hour, I'd say maybe hour and 20 minutes, Kevin MacDonald tells the story brilliantly, and he really is asking tough questions, and he's looking at what made, you know, at how John Galliano went from, you know, a young boy who was afraid of his father and whose father just treated him so badly. He did have a tough upbringing, and how he went then from, you know, the star of college to the biggest fashion designer in the world. But then when it comes to, you know, after we see the video and after we learn that, you know, about the horrible things that he said, you have all of these people around him saying, but he's not really like that. He's not racist. He's not anti-Semitic. And we see how, you know, he educated himself with the help of Jewish leaders, you know, about the Holocaust. And he educated himself so that he would never do or say anything like this again. But you're thinking to yourself, that's not good enough. There's one side of me thinking, okay, maybe he's not a completely bad person. Maybe he didn't mean the things that he said. But there's another side saying no one else gets an easy ride like this. No one else will get a second chance.
And
like
I'm sorry, Tara, I interrupted you earlier. I think you were heading in that direction of saying that, you know, it's kind of tied up in a neat chocolate box type of way, is it?
The idea that you have to get a rabbi in to teach you that the Holocaust was bad, I'm not buying that. And there's a whole bunch of things that I think he just needed to like press harder against him. And there's a moment where he puts like direct question to him, and he summons Alexis's assistant, in order to deflect. And I just felt like he'd kind of. Yeah, somebody needed to go for the jugular, and the film doesn't. No, I think he's taken an approach of I'll give him enough rope maybe, and he'll hang himself.
And did he?
I think it kind of falls between two stools. It's certainly entertaining, but I was frustrated with it. I was very frustrated.
Because there's a scene in there where we're reminded of a New York Post front page when John Galliano was photographed dressed as a Hasidic Jewish man leaving his apartment. And that whole issue seems to be laughed off. And we also have his personal assistant saying, I don't know what he was doing. And then we switch to the next story. And you're sitting there thinking, hold on. What you're saying is that he didn't take seriously what he had done there. So I think Kevin McDonald is a filmmaker here. He's made a very entertaining, riveting documentary. I just think as an interviewer and documentarian, I think he lets Galliano off lightly.
Hook stars?
I'm going to go with 4 because it is a very entertaining film. I just wish he had pushed them that little bit more. I wish he had, you know, got a little more truth out of him.
I'm going to go with 3 because I was mad as hell at the end.
Mad as hell at the end. Okay, 4 and 3 respectively then. Do not expect too much from The End of the World. An overworked production assistant called Angela hustles and shouts her way around Bucharest. This is a Romanian film.
Yes.
And I'm expecting great things at the other side of the desk here because there's disagreement the house. Yeah.
So just to say, I was on the, it's like full disclosure, I was on the jury that gave this best film at the Dublin Film International Film Festival last week. And I'm a big fan. I'm not saying it is a proper art house movie. It's 3 hours long. Yeah. And not only that, it has this daring conceit of threading in a movie from 1981 that was made during Nicola Ceaușescu's
in slow motion?
Some of it's in slow motion, some of it's not in slow motion. The slow motion bits are meant to illustrate things because in some ways what he's trying to do is be critical of the past and say, okay, this is not a golden era. However, put beside what we're actually watching in the real day and it's these kind of deliberately degraded images and how coarse everyone is comparatively and the way they eat and just the way they treat one another, it is a comparative golden age.
Okay,
but it's a really big daring film, and I do think as well, if you remember, like around 2000, we had the Romanian New Wave, and we got really brilliant films like 4 months, three weeks, and it's one of those movements that has kept going forward.
Okay, we need to know who this Angela woman is and what exactly she's doing. Because it's a fiction in that respect.
It is, yeah. Angela is an overworked and underpaid production assistant, and it is her job. This is a sort of a day in the life piece to round up candidates who used to work for this multinational but sustained life-changing injuries at work, because the multinational company they want to put together this video headed up by Nina Hoss's character, a very chilly marketing director. They want to put together this work safety video, and they want to interview people, some of whom are in wheelchairs because of their accidents at work, some of whom have lost, you know, maybe 4 fingers and one hand, some of whom have, you know, psychological scars. They want Angela to do preliminary interviews with some of these candidates, and then Nina Hoss will pick them and they'll do a shoot. But all of these candidates think that they're being interviewed, you know, and that the workers are going to give their honest stories, their honest accounts, but actually they're being duped, or at least the person who will appear in the commercial, they're being duped into saying, my accident was not my fault. So Angela is trying to round up all of these people. She knows that the people that she works for are not the best. So she channels an awful lot of her anger and her frustration into her hobby, which is pretending to be this Andrew Tate-esque oddball on TikTok, coming out with the worst imaginable things you could say. Yeah. Oh, things that we can't repeat here, basically.
Yeah, well, I read some of the ones that you had written down, Tara. I couldn't even say them out loud to myself, never mind anybody. They're pretty potty mouth. Beyond potty mouth. Yeah. In fact, that's making fun of them. They're really appalling.
Well, it is this kind of very interesting study of the absolute, like, the worst possible. Yeah. And the fact as well that she's in the film industry, which we, you know, think of as glamorous, and like, this is her life. She's pulling into layaways and, you know, like having sort of casual sex with people, and it's just all so grubby.
Yeah. So why is it so good in your book? And then we'll come to Chris afterwards.
well, it's, if you remember, so one of the things I find really, I'm a really big Radu Jude fan, but I think he's one of those people who's come into his own in his 50s. Yeah. Like, he's always done very good films, going back to like The Happiest Girl in the World, and they've always been quite sour. But he's developed this kind of anarchic streak over the last couple of films, especially Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn, which was his COVID weird comedy, which was bonkers and which won at Berlin, and this to me is just really kind of daring. It touches on everything. It touches on working life and how bad working life has become. And then the fact that she's mouthing off in these TikTok videos is like it's just incredible.
I think it's a 5-star movie from you, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a total 5-star. Chris, you are not in accord.
No, I think Ansel Manalash deserves to be huge. She is wonderful here. And I think also Alicia Manolo, sorry. And I think there are some clever ideas. There are some good stories there. I hated the fact that it kept interrupting itself with that 1981 film, and the fact that it would slow down. I thought that got in the way. The final 45 minutes, when it switches lanes and it gives us this 2-shot extended sequence of them shooting that ad, that just went on forever. And also, I just think that it's not enough to have a great performance and some very strong ideas. There needs to be some focus. But all of the takes were quite long and tedious. You know, here's Angela driving the car. Here she is eating fish. Here she is giving out about someone. Here she is sleeping in the car. It just needed to be tightened up a lot. So I do think that there's a very good film in there, but I struggled with it. And I struggled with that 163-minute runtime. It's an awful lot.
Stars?
Two.
You did no problems with 162 minutes. You wanted more time.
No, I had no problem. I actually think it needs to get to make its thesis properly and to do it side by side. Yeah. It actually has to do it exactly. It does.
Okay. That's wonderful to have a difference of opinion. Finally, Copa 71, sports documentary directed by Rachel Ramsey and James Erskine, tells this extraordinary story of the 1971 Women's Soccer World Cup in Mexico, a tournament that was witnessed by record crowds but was written out of sports history. In fact, that's how it starts, I think, yeah. Chris, isn't it? We see a contemporary footballer being shown this. So who's shown it and what happens?
It's a wonderful opening. Startling revelation. So Brandi Chastain, who is a 2-time US FIFA Women's World Cup winner, she's invited by Rachel Ramsey and James Erskine to participate in this soccer documentary, and she thinks that they're going to talk about the inaugural World Cup, the Women's World Cup in China from 1991, and they hand her a tablet and say, look at this, and it is the opening of Copa 71, which was an unofficial World Cup in Mexico City in 1971, where 100,000 fans showed up for a match between Mexico and Italy, and she cannot believe that she's never heard of this before.
Okay, well, let's listen to a clip from the film. I find this extraordinary. Trudy McCaffrey, who played for the England team back in 1971. Here she is initially being interviewed back at that time, and then subsequently you'll hear her today looking back on the time as well.
Congratulations, Trudy. What's a nice girl like you doing playing football there?
What's wrong with playing football?
Well, it's a man's game, isn't it?
No, sports for everybody. And that's
just what they are. Why are you so mad keen on football? Why don't you play hockey or something like that?
Well, I've always been football since I was about 3.
Up and down the country, ladies in proper football gear, all playing different teams.
This match was played soon after the Football Association had been nagged into allowing women's teams to play on affiliated ground.
Just the most amazing time. And
you keep losing. Do you know, you laugh at that, but it's just extraordinary that that was how she was questioned back in 1971. What's a nice girl like you doing playing football?
Yeah, there's also an official at some point who just points out that, well, women can't do any of these things because of breasts, which it's full of stuff like that. Yeah. But the real kicker is where we're headed to, and the treatment of these women
when they come home.
There's an absolutely devastating incident where the team captain, Carol Wilson. She grew up watching, you know, the great like Newcastle teams, and you know, used to go to St James's Park with her dad, and she's invited along to St James's Park, and they go, oh well, we've got a football player in the house, and they absolutely roast her and make jokes about her, and she never plays football again, and
they were all banned, weren't they?
They were banned for 6-month bans when they returned, and you know, these were women who like you know, there was no move for women to start playing football at that time. They were just women who love kicking balls against walls and things, and and they talk about their love for their game, and it's completely infectious.
And do we hear from any of the, I mean, the current, if this was because we're talking about the English team, do we hear any from any of the Lionesses commenting on what they see happened back in 1971?
Oh, we do, yeah. The filmmakers have rounded up the stars of that era. They've rounded up a lot of the lost Lionesses. They've rounded up the Italian players, particularly the midfielder Elena Chavo, the Argentine superstar Elba Selva. You know, the film is so beautifully put together, but an awful lot of that is through the participants. Like, they narrate the whole thing for us. The footage is extraordinary. I mean, I started by saying that Brandi Chastain, the US player, was wondering why she had never seen this before. The reason why she hadn't, the reason why some listeners are probably thinking, why have I never heard of that before, is because FIFA buried it. It's because when they came home,
the footage is extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, brilliant. I would pay good money to watch those full matches. They're fabulously played, full of drama as well. It's excellent.
Yeah,
it's still, the final is still the best attended game, best attended event in women's sport ever recorded.
Wow.
But it was written out of the
and
record.
And they
were
Beatle, there was Beatlemania around the English team at the time they went to Mexico.
Yeah, they were treated like rock stars.
All right, this sounds like one worth seeing, Tara.
Oh, four.
Four. And what are you saying, Chris?
I think it's equal parts infuriating and inspiring, but it's brilliant. Four stars. And I should say, I'd say a dramatic reconstruction is inevitable. I think we're probably going to see a film based on
this. All right. Well, it sounds as if it would be well worth watching. Copa 71, in the meantime, is the title of the documentary. We've also been speaking about Origin, High and Low, and they don't expect anything from the end of the world. The difference of opinion between Chris Wasser and Tara Brady. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The Latvian mezzo-soprano Elena Garanča is an opera superstar, hailed for acclaimed performances in the world's leading opera houses and recital halls, as well as with major artists and orchestras. Tomorrow night, she joins the National Symphony Orchestra at the National Concert Hall for a performance to celebrate International Women's Day with arias from Bizet, Saint-Saëns and Tchaikovsky. The occasion is significant for other reasons too. It will be Elena Garanča's first time to perform in Ireland, and the evening will be conducted by her husband, the British Gibraltar conductor Karel Mark Shishon. Garanča is at the top of her game, having recently performed the role of Kundry in a film version of Wagner's Parsifal, made by the Russian film director Kirill Serebrennikov, which he directed while under house arrest on fraud charges in Russia. Earlier today, I spoke with Elena Garanča in the National Concert Hall and was also lucky enough to get to hear some of the rehearsals. One of the arias I heard her perform this afternoon was Mon cœur s'ouvre à ta voix, Dalila, or Dalila's aria, from Camille Saint-Saëns' operatic retelling of the story of Samson and Delilah. Here in this aria, she sings of how her heart opens to the sound of Samson's voice. Elena, I've just been listening to you sing in rehearsals, and I have to tell you that when you sang
Mon cœur s'ouvre à ta voix, my heart opens to your voice, from Samson and Dalila. My heart opened and my eyes opened too. It's a phenomenal aria. She is a phenomenal character, particularly that aria.
Yeah, it's a beautiful role. It's a very, very feminine role. And sometimes, you know, when you have these kind of femme fatales, they, particularly for the mezzo-soprano, they seem to be very angry and kind of a bitter woman. And I always try to find tenderness and a really softness into each character, because I think that makes the spectrum to play much, much broader. And it's actually much more fun, you know, not just to be angry and bitchy, excuse my language, from the very beginning, but to really show tenderness. And you know, it makes sometimes, you know, you feel sorry for the character, actually, what she has to go through. So, yeah.
That makes you joyous, so, to be a mezzo-soprano as opposed to a soprano who's going to die because some awful tenor has done something terrible to her at some point along the way. The mezzo often kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I never wanted to be a soprano. Some of the soprano arias actually are appealing, but never the full character, because I also think that the sopranos tend then to be boxed in into a particular repertoire, and then you have to sing it for 25 years again and again and again, and I was always against it. And I think also the voice is not only what God has given you and what you developed in possibilities of your vocal range. It's also the character and it's also the personality that you have. And I think that I really am a mezzo-soprano. I don't like to be on a first line. I like to give, you know, a little push up the soprano, the tenor, but I don't want to carry the responsibility of the grand dame in the night. So I'm, yeah. And the variety, of course, through the boys, through the romantic, through bel canto, into, you know, more dramatic. And now, you know, at the end of Landing by Wagner, it's has been very, very satisfying for me.
Yeah, the recent Wagner Parsifal. Very interesting how this was done. It was a Vienna State Opera production, which had a very political side to how it was realized. Just tell us a little bit about that, first of all.
Well, Kirill Srebrennikov was at that time under house arrest. He was not able to travel and leave from Russia. So he sent a team out who was working on us in person. And he himself was at home watching it through two or three different servers in case something goes down in rehearsals and then in a break. So after the rehearsals, he would send us a lot of voice messages, sometimes on a calls, on a video calls. I had, I think, two Zooms before actually we started to work on this production, where he explained and told what he thought and how he saw. And I have to be very honest that for my first time, I was very happy to have a rather, you know, unconventional production, because it gave me the freedom of developing the character any way I wanted. Basically, you know, not to have that preset setup of Kundry.
And she is an interesting character in that she is both things in many ways. To use that awful phrase, she's the hag in one setting, if you like, in a traditional production. Mm. And then in another setting, she goes into the magic garden and she's the beautiful maiden. How was that realised? Because it played directly into the politics of Russia at the time, I think, didn't it?
Well, I think that all of his productions somehow rather is mirroring of not only the political situation, also the suppressed person that actually in Russia lives at this very moment for many, many years already. And I think that in a way that's also their soul. You know, a majority of the people have been suppressed under somebody, some king, some knyaz, some whoever who was leading over them. And this very occasion, I think that he actually thought much more about this manhood that they have in this piece, you know, how little women actually have to say, how much the dominance of the masculinity and masculine world actually is. And he said he couldn't find it anywhere else in society rather than in a prison. So it was actually quite interesting to work. It was very enriching because he definitely has a lot to say, and one can agree, one cannot agree. And I'm open for every possible production. It has to make sense. I would think that for the real Wagnerians, probably it was a completely absurd, but let's say for a little bit more open-minded or adventurous people, I think it was very, very interesting.
You're singing Tchaikovsky as part of the concert as well. Joan of Arc can't be a bad girl. I mean, like one could argue that Dalila is, and possibly Carmen, who you'll sing, who you're singing in this concert as well. What is the attraction of her, and particularly the aria, I think, where she's singing about leaving her own home, leaving her own fields? There's such, when after the opening kind of recitative stanza, it moves into this big Slavic type of Tchaikovsky melody, which, you know, should be played on 45 cellos, but it's sung on a voice.
Yeah, well, it's, thank God it's for the mezzo, right? Because the mezzo and the cellos really go hand in hand. I think that the deep soul of Latvian, because also the Latvians have been suppressed for so many years, and everybody who was not lazy passed through and somehow wanted to demand this land. I think we have a lot of melancholy and a lot of sentiment and sentimentality. So this music speaks to me a lot, the same as Rachmaninoff speaks to me a lot. And I intentionally also do not want to avoid this music because of the political situation nowadays, because those composers has nothing to do with what one person has decided to do nowadays. And I believe that for the mezzo-soprano, Tchaikovsky, this opera really has written a beautiful, beautiful lines. And I like in my concerts to put different music together from different intonations and different languages, and that way you can please more people.
When you sing something like that, Tchaikovsky, you talk about bringing back your Latvian soul. And she is a young, 17-year-old girl, when she's Joan of Arc, when she's singing that aria. That must bring you back to, was it summers that you spent on the lands? Because she's singing about leaving the land there, about going away from her fields and the trees and the wonderful nature all around her. Was it summers that you spent with your grandparents on a farm?
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, you can detail it to really being literal about what she's missing. I think that very often it really is about your mind of, you know, your state of mind. It's not even if she's saying about that particular mountain or that particular river, you know. Nowadays we can translate and just say about the feeling of home. Anyway, you know, a lot of people are going now on escapes, trying to find security somewhere. So her, with the goal of believing and you know, giving up the things of sacrifice, I think nowadays is actually people sacrifice too little and they start to lose the meaning actually of a reward after the sacrifice. So for me, in a way, it's also a spiritual music, particularly because there is a second time when you come back to the theme, there is a beautiful silence after you sing out one long phrase and you start it again. And those are the moments that I always try to connect with public in my concerts, and it's not so much about the bravos and loud applause. It's about that silence where you feel that, you know, 1,000 people, 2,000 people completely connect and they forget to breathe for a moment.
Carol Mark is the conductor for the concert as well. To what extent, because I was looking at the programming, you know, you have the Glinka and then the Tchaikovsky, then you have a French section with the Saint-Saëns and the Gounod and the Massenet, some of it instrumental, some of it vocal work. And then what looks to me like the second half of the concert goes very Spanish. Yes, Bizet is in there, but it's Carmen, which is, you know, Bizet letting on he was a Spanish man.
Yeah.
Do you work together on that type of programming?
Well, more or less, I tell him the arias I would like to sing. Sometimes, I mean, by now, after many, many years, I mean, we are doing the concerts together nearly 25 years already. So it's a long time of different programs and different combinations. And I tell him usually on the vocal state, let's say on that half a year or year, it's because surrounded by the repertoire I'm also doing on the operas, stages. So, and I give him, I would like to sing these arias. I can't start with that one, but I would like to finish with that. And then he does the mastery of putting the programs together. So he chooses the right pieces that he believes helps the strategy and the dramaturgy of the concert. And we tend to go to the places where we have never been to really do a whole section of Carmen, particularly with the first written Habanera by Bizet, whom he then took away and composed the original, as they call the Habanera that we all know together. But I find it very curious, actually, to sing more or less the same text, just in a different musical language. And I was thinking if probably the perception of Carmen would be very different if he would have kept this first Habanera into the piece.
What makes this version so different?
Well, first of all, it's so it's much more joyful. It's much more playful. It's I would say even sparkle. You know, the Habanera that we all know. It I always visualize my pieces somehow, and I see it like, you know, snake that goes slowly tighter and tighter and tighter, and Don José. You know, so it kind of settles what her mental state is, or what her, let's say, pulling forces. To lure somebody in, you know, and kind of just go around. Whereas the first one is much more romantic. She comes in and I would imagine, you know, jumping around or laughing and you know, maybe throwing an orange or something. And then being suddenly romantic, what is then love, you know? And then she fantasizes about it. Well, it could be for one day, it could be for 6 months. And the Habanera, what we know, it's much more of I think, reaching out for a goal that has been set.
You spoke recently in an article, which kind of knocked me for six when I, and knocked me for 10 now when I hear you speaking so passionately about music. Ah, yeah. Is it time to stop? Surely not.
I have to say there was a misunderstanding of somebody picking up a couple of lines out of a nearly 2.5 hour interview and writing it down. Of course, I think about the same as I thought when I was 17 and I started to study that one day I would like to sing Cenerentola because it has so many small notes and I want to sing the Amneris. So nearly 24 years later, the Amneris happened. So I do think about the retirement, but I don't plan it. And there are two different things. But, you know, I mean, I realize 25 years on the stage now, I've done a lot of roles, different repertoire. At some point, I will stop. I hope I can stop when I want and not when I must.
Well, having just done Wagner, I mean, and I think that Wagner, was that your first performance in Wagner? I mean, Wagner is that there you go. You're kind of at the top end of, you need to give us everything in this performance. Huge orchestras, huge arias.
Yeah.
So what, and I know you're very strategic. You've said this about yourself too in your thinking. What platform has that Wagner given you?
Well, the final. As you said, I think that's the final platform at this very moment. You know, I don't want to sound arrogantly, but what else can I lose rather than the voice after everything, you know, that I've done? And Kundry, yes, is like a run on a marathon. But I have to tell you that emotionally, Santuzza from Cavalier Rusticano, even Aida, wears you out much more.
And when the voice does finally say, that's it, Melina, you can stop now, what will you do?
Well, I mean, I can do several stops. I can stop for singing the opera repertoire, which, you know, by hurting knees and backs and stuff, a lot of my colleagues said that was one of the reasons why they gave up. There is a lead repertoire, which I absolutely adore, and I've been doing them from the very, very beginning of my career. And I'm developing now a passion also for teaching. That would be my dream, to create a small academy or small place where students who just about or about to finish their academy and have not yet entered in the business, to give them a little bit of hand of making them aware of certain things, you know, in this business.
Strategic.
Yes, yes. And I don't know, I mean, for some maybe that's been too calculative or maybe too strategic, but I believe that the long careers are done with the, you know, cool head.
Elena Grancia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Elena Grancia there speaking to me earlier today in the National Concert Hall, and I must tell you the few minutes that I spent at rehearsal today were hugely satisfying. Her voice was absolutely amazing. There are just a few tickets maybe left at this stage if you want to check out for tomorrow night's concert. Good luck if you're trying to get them. I hope that you manage to get some of the few that are left. nch.ie will give you full details.
Mickey Bereny is a singer, songwriter and guitarist best known as a member of the early 1990s indie band Lush, and she's currently a member of Poroshka. Her 2022 critically acclaimed autobiography, Fingers Crossed, How Music Saved Me From Success, tracks the trials and tribulations of being a female singer-songwriter rising to fame in the 1990s. The book also looked at her unconventional upbringing with her actress mother and journalist father and how music became her solace during difficult times. Special evening of conversation and music for International Women's Day tomorrow with pioneering alternative rock musicians Mickey Bereny and Deb Googe from My Bloody Valentine takes place at the Night Moves Festival in Drogheda. And I'm delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Mickey Bereny. It's a wonderful title that you have to the autobiography, How Music Saved Me From Success. Maybe if we go back to some of your early childhood experiences, we might get a sense of some of what you're talking about in that, Mickey. Your mother was involved in the James Bond classic You Only Live Twice. Tell me about her and the effect of seeing her success or her ability to be part of this very glamorous world. How that affected you?
Well, I mean, to be honest, when she was in You Only Live Twice, I was, technically I'm in it as well because I think she was about 3 months pregnant. So, but obviously I don't have any memory of that. But she did have a sort of modest acting career that kind of spanned a lot of my childhood. She was in, I mean, some quite odd things like, you know, telly stuff. It Ain't Half Up, Mum. She was in some... a 60s kind of series called The Protectors.
Yeah.
You know, all these a bit before my time, if I'm honest. So when she was, I think the big thing for me was when she was in Space 1999, because that kind of resonated a bit more and I actually got to go to the film set and stuff. But to be honest, she didn't massively take her career seriously and she was very typecast. Nice. But it was fun. It got me some friends at school who, you know, was quite keen to have
of Space 1999. Yeah, I would guess. But I suppose I ask about her first because your father was a journalist as well, and then they did split, and you were essentially you lived between the two of them. But I think your father was mostly the one who was part of your early upbringing in that respect. But you had no music at all in your background. And yet music became the very centre of your life, I think it's safe to say, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think music... I mean, my mum did play the piano. I think, you know, Japanese culture, it's sort of... I think my granddad was quite into sort of... there were kind of Western artists who were quite popular there. I mean, I'm literally talking quite MOR, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think... you know, certainly in terms of like any kind of career or like, you know, that kind of actual musician involvement in a world of performance, and that was not, you know, part of their world at all. I only really got into it because that was London in the 80s. That was a huge part, you know. It was very easy to fall into that. There was a whole substrata of people who went to see bands play. They were very cheap. That's what people did. Young people did in London. It wasn't that, you know, that obscure.
It's all Emma Anderson's fault, is basically what you're about to tell me. Because you went to the same private school together, yourself and Emma Anderson, and that's kind of that was the beginnings of Lush.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little gang of us. I mean, to be honest, part of it was going to a private school in London, and I would argue that all of us who were in our little gang, I mean, I don't know what private schools are like now, but back then there was a lot of people who got sent to private school who, you know, didn't necessarily have the right background for them, but their parents would kind of scrape the money together. And a lot of the people there were like properly wealthy, you know what I mean? So you were always struggling to keep up. And I think a lot of our kind of friendship and our getting into music was because we couldn't compete. We didn't have the sort of country house or the skiing, you know, the spring skiing season or whatever the hell these people do, you know, the balls and the what have you. So you get looked down on a bit and you sort of find your own niche, really. And
I mentioned
that's
in the
kind of what fed it.
Yeah, I mentioned in the introduction, you know, that in some ways you were quite definitely in a very sexist world. How bad was it for a young woman in the 90s to kind of even stand up and say, I'm going to be a musician and be part of that world?
Oh, I mean, I don't think it was that. You know, weirdly, that kind of getting involved in music was much less sexist than the kind of general outside world. Mm. I think that there was, when I started going to see bands in the 80s, there was a lot of women in bands, and that's part of what attracted it, you know, me to it, was that you weren't kind of, you know, isolated or expected to be, you know, some, I don't know, play up to some role. Mm. It was quite a bit, it was a bit of a free-for-all, actually. And a lot of the bands that we went, when early Lush started, a lot of the bands that we played with, like Debbie from the Valentines, you know,
yeah,
we were very early kind of friends of theirs, and it just wasn't a big deal. And signing to 4AD, which had like Cocteau Twins and Throwing Muses and all of these bands with women in, it actually wasn't that big a deal. Yeah. You know, that was the kind of world in which you could be a woman and not get loads of grief, actually. But I think as the money started to come in, as it got straighter, if I'm honest, you know, that's when the problems really started, because then it just became just like the rest of the bloody world.
Yeah. I suppose in a track like Lady Killers, you're talking about not so much how difficult it was to be a successful musician as a woman, but perhaps the conceited nature of men who were successful in the music industry. Would that be a fair summation of part of what's involved in Lady Killers?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I literally only wrote that song because I just found it so ridiculous, and it was just the experience of you know, a couple of incidents over that month. You know, it wasn't like I wasn't on some crusade to make this sort of feminist anthem.
Yeah,
it was literally my experience of these blokes who are like, you know, I'm up for it. You know, a bit of flirtation, it's fine. But that kind of, you know, I don't know, like, I suppose what you now get, like men, you know, those videos, like all that incel stuff, like people who kind of go on courses to learn how to kind of pick up women.
Yeah.
Like when you're being played, I think that was the thing I objected to. And, well, you know, I know it's like a current thing with Andrew Tate and that, but it was there back then as well. Yeah. You know?
Let's have a listen to Lady Killers. I just love the, it's not anger, it's just there's a great sense of back off in this track.
It's an eye roll.
An eye roll. That's a much better way of putting it. Let's have a listen. That's what an eye roll sounds like if you're Mickey Bereny. That is Lady Killers from Lush, and Mickey Bereny with me on the programme this evening ahead of our conversation. It's tomorrow night, yes, International Women's Day, with Deb Googe of My Bloody Valentine, and that was as part of the Drogheda Night Moves Festival. What about the type of music that you and the others around you, Mickey, were doing in comparison to the kind of the Britpop scene of the time? How much... out of that scene, did you feel?
I mean, I think, you know, those sort of scenes are largely kind of invented, you know, they're sort of imposed on you. I think prior to Britpop, it was, you know, supposedly we were part of the shoegaze scene. Mm. And Britpop, you know, I don't even think of it as, I don't know. I mean, these things are kind of like manipulated by economics, really. And I think Britpop was just because there was suddenly a lot of money swilling around, and what was a kind of alternative scene became quite mainstream. So there was a real feeding frenzy amongst record labels to sign the next Britpop band. So people were kind of, you know, snapping up these bands and chucking a lot of money at them. And that's really what I would argue created the moment, you know. I think there's, you know, and then everybody who wasn't doing that kind of music got kind of pushed aside. So it was a bit sink or swim, really.
Yeah, well, look, it didn't sink you, because Porashka is still on the go, and that, I'm sure, is still fulfilling the musical side of life for you. And this conversation tomorrow night with Deb Googe, I'd love to hear the two of you talking about the scene that you knew so well. I'm sure you'll have lots of good tales to share with the audience. Thanks for being with us this evening, Mickey.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
And that's Mickey Brenny. And Mickey, as I say, will be in conversation with Deb Googe from My Bloody Valentine as part of Drogheda Night Moves Festival tomorrow evening, Drogheda Arts Centre, drogheda.com. We'll give you all of the details there. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Niall Fitzmaurice researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.